If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Come day, go day. Wishing we had a sunny Sunday. Drinking buttermilk through the week. Whiskey on a Sunday.
He sits on the corner of Old Beggar's Bush on top of an old.
Well, sure now, and Faith and Bagoda and Jesus, Maddie and Joseph, and welcome aboard. All right, I understand. I hear you. St. Paddy's Day was 2 days ago, but I just kind of felt in that kind of mood. That was the Irish Rovers and Whiskey on a Sunday. First heard that song, I think, in Syracuse in 1982, probably. On St. Patrick's is a big Irish population up there, or at least a lot of people that would like to think that they're Irish. There's a bar up there on the southwest side of town in an area called Tipperary Hill, sure now. And there's a pub called Coleman's, and on St. Patrick's Day, they open at 6 in the morning. They have green beer. There is a stoplight on a street that the green light is on top and the red light's on bottom. And, you know, the Irish thing about drinking and all that, for a long time, I thought that I was Irish, that I had some Irish in me. Then my cousin Michael, who is sort of the family genealogist, said, no, we are Scottish and English, not Irish. All right, that's fine. But St. Patrick's Day, it is as much a tradition in America as it is in Ireland. No question about it. If you don't wear green on St. Patrick's Day, I really don't know what to make of you. I mean, you've got to wear something green on St. Patrick's Day if you're an American. If you're in America, I mean, come on. You know. Anyway, welcome to Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Duke Brooks here. Chat room is open for business. I believe there's somebody from Denmark in there already. We have, obviously, there have been a couple of very, very serious major news stories that have taken place since we last spoke. One of them involves the Crimean Peninsula. The other one involves Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Now, this may be apocryphal, I don't know, but it has been said, they say that William Randolph Hearst once said this. Maybe it wasn't Hearst, maybe it was Charles Foster Kane, for all I know, that the size of the news does not determine the size of the headlines, rather, you can fill in the blanks, the size of the headlines determines the size of the news. And what I think really is meant by that is that if the front page of the newspaper or the lead story on a TV or radio or internet newscast is something along the lines of man bites dog, well, that's going to be the number one. That's going to be the number one news story. No question about it. You know, man, if that is what they lead with, then that's what it's going to be. That will be absolutely the number one news story. I think, and I am pulling a little bit of news judgment here, no question about it. I think the Ukraine story is dramatically more important than the Malaysian Airlines story, and I will tell you why. What you've got to determine, and, you know, what do I know? I've only been in the broadcast business for 40 years. I only studied at the Newhouse School at Syracuse. Syracuse University, incidentally, is now out of the NCAA tournament. It's not going to happen for my beloved Orange Men, but I digress. The invasion, and look, I'm going to call a spade here. The Russians invaded the Crimean Peninsula. In case you're not aware, the Crimean Peninsula is kind of on the northwest edge of the Black Sea, all right? The Black Sea borders Russia, Crimea, Ukraine, obviously, on the north, and on the south, Turkey. And at the western end of the peninsula, of the Black Sea, there are two entrances. One, which is right on the Black Sea, is at Istanbul, and that entrance is called the Bosphorus. And a little further west, down a body of water, which I believe is called the Sea of Marmara, is an entrance into the Aegean Sea, which is called the Dardanelles. If you get into the Black Sea from the Mediterranean, you are going through the Bosphorus or you are going through the Dardanelles. That's pretty much all that there is to it. So the Russians want to control Crimea because that gives them about half of the Black Sea under their control. And they want a warm water port. That's basically what the deal is. They want a warm water port, and they want that because their other ports are places like Murmansk and Vladivostok and Port Arthur and all this kind of stuff. They cannot get their fleet can get bottled up in those by ice. That's pretty much the deal. And they want that warm water port. They've got to have it so that they can get out into the Mediterranean and thence they can go out and do their murderous mischief in the world. And that's basically what they are all about, no question about it. So, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, that is what the Russians want. And that is why they went into the Crimea, and there are a lot of people who are absolutely certain that they went in there because there are ethnic Russians in there, and, you know, for Pete's sake, the ethnic Russians, they've got to go in there and protect the ethnic Russians. Now, I don't think Hillary Clinton has ever said anything that I've ever agreed with. Well, maybe one thing. On one occasion, she said something like, I just happen to think that freedom is a pretty good thing to be fighting for. I would agree with that statement. But, of course, her idea of freedom and our idea of freedom are two different things. But I digress. In any event, Hillary did compare Putin's invasion of the Crimea to Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland, which is today known as Czechoslovakia. And the fact of the matter is, I believe that she is right about that. So, you know, this is basically what Hillary has done. I think that she is correct. I think that Putin had absolutely no business whatsoever going in there. The people that live in that Crimean Peninsula, which has been a hotspot for a very, very long time, if they really wanted to live in Russia, I suppose they could have moved there. The Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula that it owns, frankly, those are sovereign countries, and there is absolutely no reason for Russia to go in there. None. Putin simply wants the territory. Now, the Wall Street Journal, and incidentally, we're going to have Dr. David McIntyre West Point graduate and chair of the Department of Homeland Security at the National Graduate School. He's going to be joining us in about 7 or 8 minutes. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Five reasons Putin gave for annexing the Crimea. I say invade, they say annex, potato, potato, whatever. One, returning Crimea to Russia rights an historical wrong. Putin claims that transferring authority of Crimea to Ukraine in 1954 was a violation of Soviet law, and returning it to Russian control corrects that mistake. He said that when Soviet leader or Soviet ruler Nikita Khrushchev signed Crimea over to Ukrainian control, no one expected that the Soviet Union would break up, and that when it did, Crimea was handed over, quote, like a sack of potatoes, quote. What used to seem incredible unfortunately became reality. A big country was no more. Well, if the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, then Soviet law does not obtain. Listen, you know, Putin is a dancer. Crimea needs to be part, this is number two, Crimea needs to be part of a strong and stable state. Putin claimed that there is no legitimate authority in Ukraine, which puts those living in the predominantly ethnic Russian region under threat. He said Russia has a responsibility to defend its compatriots, that's in quotes. Besides, the result of a weekend referendum that showed an overwhelming majority of Crimeans voting to secede from Ukraine and join Russia is proof that this was the will of the people. He cited examples like Kosovo splitting off from Serbia as an historical precedent. With tongue in cheek, he must have said that, yeah, it's a free and open election with Russian troops everywhere. Come on, man. This guy, what I think is ridiculous is that Obama and John Kerry and and people like that and Biden, they actually take what Putin is saying seriously. Number three, Russia doesn't intend to seize more of Ukraine. Despite the massing of Russian troops along the Ukrainian border, Mr. Putin says Russia has no intention to take control of more territory in eastern Ukraine. Of course not. Of course he doesn't. You can trust him, can't you? Number four, the West crossed a red line by backing the new government in Kiev. Mr. Putin accused Western powers of hypocrisy by standing behind the new government in Kiev, a regime that he said illegally seized power in a late February coup. He said this undermined any argument that Russia's occupation of Crimea and the referendum there to secede was illegal. The West doesn't recognize the results of Sunday's vote and calls the whole thing illegitimate. Yeah, I guess so. And number five, and this is the most obvious one, the modest sanctions leveled against a small list of Russian government officials on Monday by the West doesn't bother Russia, said Putin. Many of the targeted officials laughed off the announcement of asset freezes and visa bans against them, saying they have no holdings abroad, so the sanctions will have little effect. No, the sanctions will have no effect. This guy's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. It's about 13 minutes after the hour. 718-305-7176 is the number. The invasion of Crimea should come as no surprise. Anybody that listened to Sarah Palin in 2008 would not be surprised by it. I wasn't surprised by it. Something else that comes as no surprise is the fact that our United States Constitution, which is the basis of our nation and the central core of our values, is under attack. Sometimes seems like everybody and his brother is trying to figure out an end run around the articles and amendments of the greatest governing document of all time. Now, if you are tired of leftists and unfriendly political forces telling America that our Constitution is a mere footnote or a, quote, living document, unquote, be advised that a lot of real Americans like you and like me are going to come together at the Defend the Constitution rally in Waynesboro, Tennessee, about an hour southwest of Nashville, on the weekend of April 26th. Great speakers like Scotty Nell Hughes, Karen Vaughn, Joe Carr, and our very own Kathy Hinners will be on hand, to name just a few. Also, I believe that Uncle Bing Fisher and Dave Vance, two of our hosts, are going to be there. It's also going to be a bunch of great music, great food, and a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight, Henry the Horse dances the waltz. Go to defendtheconstitutionrally.com to learn more about this great event, and I very much do sincerely hope to see you there. We've got to do something to send a message to the people in Washington that we, the people, know what the Constitution says. We know what the Constitution is all about. We know that it says what it means. It means what it says. And some of these screwball interpretations that these legislating judges have come up with are insulting to us. Anyway, we are going to take a quick break. When I come back, I expect to be joined by Dr. Dave McIntyre. We're going to talk about the Crimea, the Ukraine, and all things having to do with national security, so don't go away.
80 million voters can pull the wrong lever, and it's still the wrong lever.
What does it take to be the leader in production systems technology? To be the one company that solves production problems at any plant, for any product, and with any technology? It takes a 30-year record of success. It takes total mastery of complex technologies with a history of delivering success every time, without fail. Only one company can claim that high ground in manufacturing line optimization, data automation, and systems integration, and that's Philadelphia Control Systems. In factories worldwide, Philadelphia Control Systems programs, software, and engineering solutions deliver optimal performance and output flow with a record that can't be matched. Any plant, any product, any technology. Philadelphia Control Systems, the leader in production automation since 1982. 800-335-9811, pcsforautomation.com. That's PCS, the number 4, automation.com.
One goat can make the difference between nourishment and hunger. One goat can make the difference between poverty and sustained income. In the war-torn areas of southern Sudan, one goat can make the difference between life and death. Find out how you can help. Visit goatsfortheoldgoat.org. That's goats, F-O-R, theoldgoat.org. Fighting hunger, one goat at a time.
Hello, I am Robert Garding of the New Wise Conservatism radio show, heard on Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, through conservativenationmedia.com. Being on the air since 2007 from behind the silver CNN microphone of freedom, we've helped people become more informed to keep socialists out of the White House and Congress. But that work isn't over yet. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern on CNN for the New Wise Conservatism radio show, the voice of reason in our unreasonable world.
You're listening to Duke Books on conservativenationradio.org.
All right, welcome back. This, of course, Sinead O'Connor, continuing the kind of Irish St. Patrick's Day inspired theme of at least the breaks on tonight's show. Duke Brooks here. This is Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. The number is 718-305-7176, and I'm looking forward to your calls. You can give me a shout at any time. Yes, you, sir, there. I see you there. You can give me a call. I am a lot more concerned about the situation in the Crimea and the actions of Putin, who is nothing more than a former KGB thug. That's all that the guy is. And he is an expansionist. He wants Russia to return to, no doubt, what he thinks are the glory days of the USSR, more than anything. That's very, very clear. It's very, very obvious. And I think that this is probably his opening gambit in that. I think this story is more important for a variety of reasons than the Malaysian Airlines story, not the least of which is the fact that the our so-called leadership in Washington is simply not on the ball. You will recall that during the 2012 presidential election debates, Governor Mitt Romney, who was our GOP nominee, all right, he wasn't Ronald Reagan. You know, he wasn't perfect, but he would have been an awful lot better than we've gotten there now. I mean, come on, man. He said that Russia was the largest and most serious geopolitical threat that we faced. Obama and his friends in the media, of course, dismissed this. They gave it the back of their hand. They made fun of Governor Romney by saying the 1980s called and they want their foreign policy back. Okay? Obviously, the president was completely wrong about that. The president is a guy that looks at the world through theory and not through reality. And that is why he missed this particular event coming up. He just, you know, to him, he was just absolutely shocked that the Russians did this. I don't know. Maybe we ought to start calling them the Soviets again, because that's what Putin wants to do. He wants to revive that old Russian Soviet evil empire. The guy's basically he's a fascist. He's a communist. Communism is fascism. You don't think so? You want to talk about it? 718-305-7176. I remember getting into a discussion at one of my prep school reunions with a couple of my old friends from Old Penn Charter who were very serious leftists in school. Now they're all very successful in a capitalist economy, but they are politically still very left-wing. And I mentioned something about somebody being what I call a Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist, Maoist, Communist, Socialist. And they were very, very, you know, one of them said, well, all those things are completely different, so, you know, I don't see how you can possibly, and I said to him, no, Jeff, they are not different. They are all the same, because under all of those things, the man in the street, John Q. Citizen, as it were, has no rights, he has no future, and he has no hope. So those things are all the same. And I think one of those guys, might have been Dave, well, whoever it was, said something like, well, nobody has any rights or future or hope under this system that we live in. And I didn't even bother dignifying that with a response, because it was so ideologically driven and so absurdly stupid. Unbelievable. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Michael Smith may be calling in later. I'm still waiting on Dr. David McIntyre to discuss the situation at the Crimea. You may be aware that we had some audio problems last week. I hope that we're not having any audio problems right now. I'm going to look in the chat room and see if our Danish correspondent, Christian, can hear me. Apparently he can. Apparently he can. He observes that the Muslims, not Putin, should have our attention. Well, Christian, I think that both of them need our attention. You know, I remember when the Mohammedans at one point, and they were Chechnyans, whatever that is. I know what that is. I know where it is. Never been there. But they attacked a Russian school They killed a bunch of Russian children. I don't remember what Putin did about that. It's not necessary that if they did something that they would have publicized it. You know, the mindset in Russia, even though they are not the Soviet Union anymore, Russia has never been a country where the kind of freedoms that we seek or in the West or take for granted in this country have ever really blossomed. They just don't. They've never had a free press there. They're kind of toying with the idea right now, but if some newspaper publishes something that Putin doesn't like, how long do you think it's going to be before the Committee for State Security goes in there and takes that place apart? We don't do that in this country. There are liberals that think that we do. I don't know of any conservatives that think that we can do that, but we just don't. That is a Western thing. Thank you, Christian, for advising me that that we sound all right tonight. Always helpful to have Christian aboard. Christian, you can call in at any time you wish at 718-305-7176. I am waiting on Dr. David McIntyre. I do expect him to be calling in at some point soon. We've got about 3.5 minutes until we go to our first hard break at the bottom of the hour. Here at Radio Free America and ConservativeNationMedia.com, the commies, are the Russians rather, and the Mohammedans are both deserving of our attention. Why? Because we have not shown them the kind of resolve that a world superpower should show to people who are threatening our security and safety. There's no existential threat against America. No nation on this earth can militarily destroy this country. It cannot be done. Abraham Lincoln at one point made a comment that all of the combined armies of Europe and Asia could not take a drink by force from the Ohio River in the trial of a century. In other words, he was saying that no other army would ever be able to physically invade the United States and make it as far as the Ohio River by force. And I believe he's right about that. If we were to let the military do what the military in this country knows how to do, you'll notice that when Ronald Reagan used the military, we were in, we were out. The one mistake was when we sent the Marines to garrison the Beirut, Lebanon airport. I don't know which fancy, long-haired, fuzzy-thinking Harvard think tank, Washington, D.C., career State Department, foggy bottom, pseudo-intellectual came up with that plan, but I guarantee you it wasn't Ronald Reagan and it wasn't Vice President Bush at the time. When Vice President Bush realized that we had to go in to Kuwait to liberate Kuwait from the control of Saddam Hussein, and I suspect that decision was made at some point prior to August 3rd, 1990, because that invasion took place on August 2nd. And the fact of the matter is, President George H.W. Bush, a lot of people say, oh, man, you can't trust him. He was a skull and bones. All right, hey, listen, let me tell you something. If I had gone to Yale, I would have loved to have been invited to be a member of Skull and Bones. That isn't for just anybody, okay? but I digress. He was also a war hero in World War II, and he understood that the American military has a job to do. When the American military does its job and it is unhindered by political considerations, domestic political considerations, that it does its job very, very well. He was absolutely correct about that. And the other thing is that, as I mentioned, he was a war hero in World War II, and for that reason, everyone in our military understood that, and when he gave an order as commander-in-chief, he had absolute moral authority to give those orders, because everybody in the military knew that when he wore the uniform, he fought for the country, he was in actual mortal combat against a very serious enemy, he had taken fire from the enemy, and they were more than happy to follow his orders because, to put it in the vernacular, he had been there, done that. Anyway, we are now at the bottom of the hour. You know, just when you think you have heard everything, those leftists in Washington try something else. They're going to keep on doing it until we, the people, run them out of town on a rail. But what about between now and then? I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing the beginning of the end of this column left march in Washington starting in November of this year, but I digress. My question is, what are you going to do to protect your family, your property, and your sacred rights as an American when the left-wingers try to redistribute food and who knows what else in the name of social justice? Don't wait for the left to turn our world upside down. Get ready now. Make sure you can provide for your family in an emergency by going to the Patriot Depot, America's best-known warehouse for all your patriotic gear and survival needs. Just go to our website, conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the Patriot Depot banner. You'll find everything from the emergency food supplies to the patriotic gear you'll need today and in the future. That's Patriot Depot at conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. More is coming up. Stay right where you are.
Go, Caleb!
Come on, hit a homer, Jesse!
Let's go, guys!
Hey, did you guys know that kids who play sports earn more money when they grow up?
Of course. I knew that.
Hey, did you guys know that kids who read books have a bigger vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Wow, jinx. Did you guys know that friendly children have more friends?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. I knew that. Did you guys know that winter babies are better at music?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, pretty obvious.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Obvious. Oh, hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
Huh, I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure I knew that.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group. That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship. And what breed would you say Satchmo is? I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier hound chihuahua-looking kind of mix. Tremendous dog. I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous. You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this. Now, let's see him in action. Look how he makes eye contact with his person. That's actually known as the treat stare. How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles. Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group. And finally, the loving face lick. It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks. Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one. Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Kevin Wade, and you're listening to Conservative Nation Radio. Real conservatism for real conservatives.
Hi, welcome back to Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. That, of course, the mighty Enya, massive major star from the 90s, I was reading about her the other day. Her real name is, well, it's in Gaelic, and frankly, I can't pronounce it. It was anglicized to Eileen Brennan or something like that, and then she went back, you know, to her Gaelic roots. I think that woman has made like $100 million in the music business, and the fact of the matter is she is so talented, she deserves it, you know. Ireland had a law a while back that was zero taxes for artists, poets, musicians. I think that they did away with that. I don't know. You know, I hear the left constantly complaining about the salaries paid to people that run large corporations or the return on investment that is realized by people that make smart and wise investments. And the left begrudges those people that. And, of course, all of the left-wing doctrines, Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist, Communist, Maoist, Socialism, all those things are based on jealousy. Some people say, no, it's about justice. Well, look, you can call jealousy justice all day long. It is still jealousy, all right? 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. We've got about 23 and a half minutes left in this hour of Radio Free America, and Chi-Chi, the dog, agrees how utterly and completely embarrassing I used to complain to other people. Someone in the chat room has just mentioned that equality is the new jealousy. He's exactly right about that. No question about it. There's a difference between the president very often used to speak about what he referred to as a level playing field. What he was really talking about was not a level playing field. He was talking about spotting one team points while the game was underway, or perhaps moving the goalposts to favor one team over the other, lowering the basket, having umpires that in contradiction to Major League Baseball, apparently, and my dad told me this, so I know it was true, has a rule that you can't be an umpire unless you have also been certified as legally blind. I looked in the rule book. I didn't find it. It must have been a misprint because I know that my dad was right. So, you know, the president really, when he talks about a level playing field, he is actually talking about this left-wing concept that you hear a lot about today, especially in, quote, education, unquote, circles, which is called equality of outcome. In other words, there are people in the NEA, the AFT, the U.S. DO Education, Department of Education, that have this belief that if you have children in a classroom, one of them has an IQ tested at 115 and another one has an IQ tested at 96, that the one who graduates with the 115 IQ should not have any more knowledge or be any more capable of making their way in the world than the one who graduates with an IQ of 96. To me, that does not make any sense. Now, let us join our Danish correspondent, Christian. What's happening, my friend? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really, really well over here in Denmark, and I'm enjoying your nice show tonight.
Thank you.
I was just thinking, you know, about all this Putin stuff. You know, there's no doubt that the mistakes Obama makes is that You think that by showing friendliness and openness, that it would be received in that good fashion. But when people like the Mohammedans and like Putin, when they see friendliness, what we see as friendliness, they see as weakness, a weakness that they feel obliged to take advantage of. And that's a mistake that Obama is really making. And it's really weird, you know, that he's making those kind of mistakes because, you know, he has a Muslim background, so he must know how they think, you know.
Well, I think, I am thinking that in reality, this is shades of Neville Chamberlain is really what it is. The fact of the matter is that you've got a bully out there, you've got a tough guy, and you are simply not going to be able to appease that person. That just can't be done.
And I understand that. Hello?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. David, is that you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Christian,
shall I call in later?
Well, yeah, why don't you do that? I've just made contact with Dr. Dave McIntyre.
I'll call him later.
All right. Thank you, my friend. Thank you very much. David, I'm very sorry that you and I got our communications wires crossed. I thought you were going to call me, but then I just double-checked your email. But I'm very glad that you're aboard. How are you, Doc?
Fine. Fine, buddy. How about you?
Not bad. I'm a little bit worried about the situation in the Crimea. I have recently rediscovered the brilliant poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson called The Charge of the Light Brigade. And I know that you're familiar with it, and I know that you're familiar with the Crimean War that was fought in the 1850s by the Brits and the French and the Ottomans against the Russians. And Russia has always wanted to have control of that peninsula. What do you think what is so important about it? They want a warm water port, but Russia borders on the eastern end of the Black Sea. What's the big deal about the Crimea?
Well, that is several things. The first is that they have significant naval facilities there. It's one thing to say, yeah, they border on the far end of the Black Sea, but they don't have the big port facilities. The Soviet Navy, the part that was going to engage in the Mediterranean, maybe as far out as in the open ocean in the Atlantic. Anything, when we say warm water, anything that's not in the winter months is going to have to come through the Bosphorus and through the Black Sea and the Bosphorus. Up north, ice closes out or makes the routes dangerous most of the year. So you've got an enormous nation, and if they want at all to look to the west with the kind of ocean trade that our economy depends on, they've got to move through this area. Consequently, they concentrated their navy there on the Crimean Peninsula. At the end of the Cold War, they broke the navy, I guess you would almost in half, and provided part of it to the Ukraine at a base nearby, and the rest of it stayed with Russia at a Russian base, which they have leased from the Ukraine. But essentially, their argument is, hey, we paid for all of these ships. We bought all of these ships. We agreed to let the Ukraine control them, but this is a largely Russian population, and we see the presence essential to us. And when there was an uprising in the western part of Ukraine that threatened to turn Ukraine away from us and maybe threaten our position of these ports, we had no choice but to abide by the wishes of the people in the area, largely Russian, and incorporate Crimea into Russia.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, the way I look
at
things...
that's their argument.
Their argument is
this is not an invasion, as Putin said. Not a single... Have you ever heard of an invasion where not a single person was killed? This is... They would argue that if you take a look at the Ukraine, it's split about 60-40 by the Dnieper River in the middle, and this peninsula, Crimean Peninsula, is way in the south, and it's almost 100% Russian ethnically. The eastern part, east of the river, is about 60-70% Russian ethnically, and then west of that is mostly Ukrainian and not Russian. ethnically. And so I'd be very surprised if they end up being satisfied with just that Crimean Peninsula. I do expect them eventually to look for the eastern third or 40% of the Ukraine to fall into their orbit as well, under their control as well.
Yeah, but Putin said he has no intention of doing that. You got to
believe
it.
You know,
he said with tongue firmly in cheek, you know, I mean,
Duke,
come on, man.
You kid or you? You kid or you? Look, one of the important things in trying to do strategic analysis is to look at geography. We tend to discard geography and history and culture because we're trying to enforce policies. You know, we have policies. One of those policies is the United States doesn't deal with terrorists. Another policy is we won't stand for a democratic government, you know, to be overthrown. But policy doesn't always stand up in the face of strategic reality. So you have to look at geography, you have to look at ethnicity, you have to look at a military reality. And if you look at the military reality of this situation, hard to do this on radio, but if you could sort of capture in your mind, Russia, this enormous country, is separated from Europe by Ukraine in the middle. And at the south of the Ukraine is the Black Sea, and sort of in the middle of that is this big landmass, which is called a peninsula, the Crimean
right.
Peninsula. It's not like Florida. It's almost like a giant island, and it's connected to the land of Europe in only one place. So if you want gas, food, fuel, electricity, internet connectivity, if you want anything on the Crimean Peninsula where his large force base is, it has to come across that small land bridge. Well, that small land bridge does not lead east to Russia. It leads north into this part of the Ukraine that is heavily Russian in ethnicity. So geography suggests
that bridge has a lot of water. That small land bridge looks to me to be a lot of soft land, swamps, small lakes, ponds, rivers. It looks like there's a reservoir there. It's not all that easy to move an army across it. So,
but remember, we're not talking about moving. We're not talking about moving an army. We're talking about moving supplies south into Crimea.
All right.
So my suggestion is that they need that, whatever he says. He ultimately needs the part of Ukraine to the north, which connects to Russia, in order to support his forces in the Crimean Peninsula to the south. There are highways across that area, and so he needs to look north for his resupply. And so geography suggests that he's going to have to eventually incorporate that part of Ukraine, which is connected to the Crimean Peninsula, for the same reason. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him do it the same way, a popular uprising that demands that they be associated with Russia, and he accedes to the demands of the local people. That's the way I would see this playing out over some period of time. Now, the question is, what do we do about that?
Yeah, and that is the question. The other question is, what kind of a person in Washington, D.C. would allow our country and the West in general and NATO to be blindsided by this? There was one situation when Israelis greeted someone, and I forget who it was, at the airport in Tel Aviv, and they were all holding black umbrellas. And they were doing that because when Neville Chamberlain came back to the Croydon airport, holding that piece of paper and said, when I was a little boy, I was told if at first you don't, you know, that was the metaphor for that. And, Neville Chamberlain's policies did not work. And I don't think President Obama's, he's just not up to it to deal with a real thug and a bully who is also smart and a nationalist like Putin.
Duke, I guess what I'd suggest to you is that this is the culmination of a 20-year, in fact, reaching back far beyond that, but certainly at the time the wall went down, a 20-year effort by progressives, for lack of a different term, to reshape a new world order. That new world order being based on economic ties, international regimes, cooperation between countries, that we weren't going to have to depend on nations, nation states, national military any longer. We were going to be able to ensure the peace of the world through international regimes and cooperation. And that's been an effort. So the position we're in today is not an accident. We have actively maneuvered for 20 years to get us there. I mean, the United States was a party to the agreement to put in the gas lines from Russia into Germany and all of Europe, which now allows Putin to essentially hold Europe by the throat with these threats. The United States was a party to the division of the Ukraine in this way. In fact, I'd be very surprised. If you go back here about 6 weeks, there was this very curious incident, which you may recall, where our U.S. Representative, our undersecretary for Europe and the Mideast, was taped by the Russians in a conversation with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And she was embarrassed that she essentially used some very rude language about the EU, and that was released to the public, and she essentially said, hey, we don't need them, and, you know, F them. Well, the question that everybody missed at the time was her discussion, this big deal about this was not that she used a rude language. The big deal was she was discussing with the ambassador of the Ukraine who the United States wanted to see in power after the riots. What riots? This was several weeks before the riots. So the suggestion, the clear suggestion, is that we were a party to this uprising that pushed the Russian-leaning president out of office and sort of forced Putin's hand. So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is it is not just Obama in the current moment of weakness. This has been a concerted effort over 20 years to weaken the American hand and put more power into international regimes, and in this moment of crisis, those regimes have failed us.
Well, very interesting. I'm presuming that woman is still working at Foggy Bottom for John Kerry.
I certainly would be surprised if she's not.
Yeah,
I've heard nothing to the contrary. You know, another interesting component of this is there's been one mechanism entirely absent from this entire discussion. Never heard it mentioned. Where's the United Nations on this?
Good question.
The United Nations. Yeah, and the answer to that is, we've been a party for a long time in giving the Soviet Union, now Russia, a veto in action. So, in theory, under international law, anyone who believes they've been invaded, as the Ukraine does, could take the case to the United Nations. But we've been a party in ensuring that Russia has a veto there, and consequently, you know, there's another international mechanism which can't work. And so I guess what I'm suggesting to you in short, Duke, is that the Secretary of State said recently that Putin can't get away with this. What is he thinking, you know, that in the 21st century that military might still matters? You know, doesn't he understand the New World Order? I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that the New World Order is beginning to look more and more like the Old World Order, where power really matters.
Well, it certainly does. There's no question about that. I mean, I guess my thinking on this is Crimea now, the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania next, under the justification or the rationalization that Putin would have to do something to secure the outlying part of Russia called Kaliningrad or Ekaterinburg,
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm,
you know the
mm-hmm.
piece that I'm talking about there.
Yes, it's kind of cut off.
If he can do this and get away with it, why couldn't he do that and get away with it?
Yeah, significant military bases in that vicinity, Russian military bases in the vicinity of what you're talking about as well. Well, I want to be really careful because any comparisons to the Second World War, anytime you raise Hitler, you know, you really are you can have a flash fire when you don't intend one at all. But let me just suggest that Hitler made one small step and another small step and another small step mm-hmm. in his campaign of enlargement. And by the way, you know, 38, 40, 41, 38, 39, 40, all the places that he were moving, Alsace-Lorraine and into Czechoslovakia and so forth, his argument was, hey, these are ethnically German people. Anyway, we're just collecting
correct.
Them. And then he turned his eyes to Poland.
Austria,
right.
You bet. Absolutely. All
then,
those
then
things.
Then he turned his eyes to Poland. And what he ignored was the idea that there was a treaty with Great Britain and Poland, and that Great Britain saw this not as the incorporation of populations, but this would be genuinely an attack on the international order. And so he expected Great Britain to do nothing, where Great Britain saw the move into Poland to be a completely different thing from the move into Czechoslovakia. Well, when you describe the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, I would suggest we have a similar situation and that this is a wholly different issue. These are members of NATO. We have signed a treaty agreement. We have said their soil is the same as our soil. We will be committed to fight with our military to defend them just as we would to fight to defend Texas or Florida or Alabama. And so if he is tricked by our current weakness into thinking there would be no response to the move into those NATO states, then there's very good reason for your worry. We really have set ourselves up through weakness for a very difficult test.
Now, you know an awful lot more, and incidentally, my good friend Jake Danishevsky, who was born in the Soviet Union but is now an American, he'll be joining us in a couple of minutes right after the top of the hour.
Oh, good.
He's on hold right now, and everyone enjoys speaking with Jake. He is truly a great guy, and he is the kind of immigrant that I want to see coming into this country, because he is playing by the rules, but we'll speak with him. If Putin does make a move towards Western Europe, I suspect if he makes it as far as the Oder River, which is the border between Germany and Poland, as you're aware, that the Germans will pretty much destroy any Russian army in detail that tries to get into Germany. I just think that the German is a better soldier man for man than the Russian is. What do you think?
You know, it's very hard for us to speculate on that for lots of reasons. Russia certainly has been short on funding since the end of the Cold War. Their military is much improved over a few years ago when in the first Chechen War they essentially literally had their heads handed to them where Soviet draftees were executed and their heads cut off and put on sticks in Chechnya. They have significantly improved. However, they are nothing close to the massive military bear that they were 30 years ago. On the other hand, NATO is no longer the force that it was once was. You know, we moved the last American tank out of Europe about 18 months ago. You know, first tank on European soil in the attacks into Italy in 1943, and there are essentially two brigades on the ground. So I'm not sure there's enough on either side right now for a major clash of forces. I would see something quite differently. I think if he were to be foolish enough to move that far, that he would have to worry much more about local uprisings, which no doubt we would fund and support. And the piece nobody's talking about here is the role that cyber war is likely to play. Thus far, he really, he makes a compelling argument, which I disagree with, but he makes a compelling argument to say, we haven't killed anybody. We haven't had an actual invasion, although clearly they have. These are just Russians who asked us in. If you start talking about going to Poland or into a NATO country, that's an entirely different thing. And then we're going to see cyber forces unleashed that nobody can predict where that goes. If for no other reason, Duke, then it's very hard to tell who's mounting a cyber attack. If Kremlin computers are shut down, if our Department of Defense is attacked, is it anonymous? Is it China? Is it Russia? If serious damage is done, physical damage is done to the American electrical system, who did it? Who do we blame? Who do we retaliate against? So it begins. I'm not so worried about who's the better soldier, who has the stronger tanks in a future conflict. I'm very worried about the ability to control it and contain it and keep it focused on Ukraine or some small part of Poland or Estonia, Latvia. That's really what worries me.
Well, the entire thing is particularly scary. Can I ask you to stand by? We're going to take some news here at the top of the hour.
Sure, sir.
If you will stand by with us, I will be bringing in Jake Danishevsky in a moment or two. We are going to be checking news from Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. with Jeff Holtzman. That's coming up momentarily here on conservativenationmedia.com. This is Radio Free America. Duke Brooks here. Stay right where you are.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Good evening. For Talk Radio News Service, I'm Jeff Holtzman. A Senate bill to extend federal unemployment insurance for roughly 1.3 million Americans is unworkable, says House Speaker John Boehner. In a statement, Boehner cited a letter written to leading senators by a group of directors who administer state unemployment insurance programs. The officials said that the requirements in the bill would cause considerable delays in the implementation of the program and increased administrative issues and costs. The officials added that a majority of states have said that implementing the proposed legislation could take anywhere from 1 to 3 months. Boehner said that the complaint shows that the serious problems with the Senate legislation are cause for serious concern. A better use of the Senate's time, he said, would be taking up and passing the dozens of House-passed jobs bills that are still awaiting action. Supporters of the Senate bill said last week that they have enough votes to send the bill over to the House. But with Boehner now throwing cold water on the plan, it's doubtful that the bill will make its way to President Obama's desk. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
Whether you're on active duty, a veteran, or just admire American Armed Forces, there's no better place to get the widest variety of militaria than at Highlands Militaria. Highlands Militaria is one of America's premier distributors of Fox tactical gear and outdoor products. Veteran-owned and operated, Highlands Militaria offers new and used uniforms and insignia from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and today, with an emphasis on airborne and special operations insignia, gear, collectibles, and uniforms. If you need to replace a cherished badge or unit patch, or just want to gear up for your next outdoor adventure, go to Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, where you'll find the best supply of the military gear you need. Shipping is always free with one-day handling time, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria. And thank you for your service.
As I went through school, one giant question loomed over me. What did I want to be? But in order to know what I wanted to be, I had to first decide what I wanted to make. I wanted to make more. So I became a teacher. Now I make learning a privilege, not a chore. And frustration, a tool, not an obstacle. I make working hard seem easy, and giving up, impossible. I make an old subject feel like a fresh thought, and unconventional methods common. I make material things less important, and little things like patience and kindness count. I make weekdays more exciting than weekends, and classrooms feel like anything but. I make things different, which is all I ever hoped for. I'm a teacher. I make more.
Find out how you can make more at teach.org. Make more. Teach. Brought to you by Teach and the Ad Council.
A little bit of Dexy's Midnight Runners there and the Celtic Soul Brother. I am not a Celtic Soul Brother, but I sure do like their music. I don't drink, incidentally. You know, a lot of people do a lot of drinking and celebrating on St. Patrick's Day. I have a good friend, a major radio executive in this country, whose name is Tom McKinley. With a name like that, you know he's not Italian. Tom on one occasion referred to St. Patrick's Day as amateur night. I thought he said, I stay home. All right, very fine. Let us bring back Dr. David McIntyre from the National Graduate School. And, Doctor, you are chair of the Department of Homeland Security Studies at National Graduate School, correct?
Yes, although this year I actually have shifted my focus to the Bush School at Texas A&M, where I'm teaching four courses in Homeland Security, Emergency Management, an overview course, and students that are working on a two-semester project on how local communities use risk management, which is turning out to be very interesting. So, I still work with the National Graduate School, a very good business organization focused on quality management, but my current academic focus is with the Bush School at Texas A&M.
Have you run into my friend Cheryl Landry down there at the Bush School, big, tall, blonde girl, very good-looking, from Delaware?
I have not crossed paths, but I'll certainly look for someone with those characteristics.
Oh, yes. She's very hard to miss. Now then, we have been talking about Russia, and I think we ought to go primary source on this. And let me bring in my good friend Jake Danishevsky, who was born in the Soviet Union and is now an American. And Jake is the author of the book Aftertastes and Tales from Russia. And Jake, say hello to Dr. David McIntyre, and welcome aboard, my buddy.
Hello, Duke. Hello, Doctor. And hello to your guests. I'm happy to be here, and I heard part of the show, and I'm honored to be here.
Well, we're very honored to have you. Now, you grew up in Russia, and what is your, as a native Russian, what is your view of the Black Sea and the Crimea, and you know, what is your relationship as a native Russian with that landmass and those people? What do you think?
Well, first let me say, and I hope I'm not repetitive because I only heard part of the show, but let me say that that region is going to be inevitable, and I'm sorry to say this, I feel it's going to be inevitable that there will be a civil war. And I'll tell you why. One is because Putin is not a type of a guy. He's not type of a person to use big words. If he says he's going to do something, not out of respect for Putin, not out of liking for Putin, but if he says he's going to do something, he's going to go ahead and do it. So if he says he wants to take Crimea back, which is actually a very nice resort type of a place, we've been there many times with my family while I was still a child. And if Putin says he wants to take it back, he will most probably try to do it. He's not just going to say, well, give me Crimea and then step away. So I have a strong feeling that all it will take is one shot from one side or the other, and we will have a civil war. On the other hand, I heard you guys speak about Putin invading Western Europe. I doubt he would do that because I don't think he wants all-out war with the rest of the nations. Putin looks at Ukraine as still part of his nation, the nation that he wants to put back together. Putin might not want communism back, but he definitely wants Soviet Union back. That's my feeling on that.
Doctor, what do you think?
Oh, I think he's right on target there. Hear a lot of news folks talking about Putin and that he's a thug and they expect him to be invading and all the lands that he wants to collect. And from a strategic perspective, which is my background, not a cultural perspective, or actually being raised in Russia or with Russians, from a strategic perspective, that this makes perfect sense, that he would include the areas that he believes belong to him anyway, but not from his perspective, he is a stickler from international law. Now, we may disagree with his perspective, but from his perspective, he talks about international law a lot. I'd be very surprised to see him cross international borders, for example, into Poland.
Yalta is on the Crimean Peninsula. Balaklava is on the Crimean Peninsula. Sevastopol is on the Crimean. These are all names from world history, from World War II.
Right.
going back to the middle of the 19th century. This has been a serious trouble area for almost 200 years now. And I, you know, now let me ask you this, Doctor, what about the idea of NATO pulling up in the Aegean outside the Dardanelles and basically blocking the Russian fleet from coming out? It's okay for them to go in, but they're not allowed to leave. How about something like that?
Well, I think a military blockade of a nation would be considered an act of war. Yeah, and certainly now I'm talking from a sort of the strategic perspective here, not just from an American perspective. I think we would find a great deal of resistance back in the United Nations about that. We haven't been threatened. NATO nations haven't been threatened. Any of the nations that are providing ships to conduct that blockade, they haven't been threatened. Under what article of the United Nations charter would we justify any military action against Russia? See, this is the problem. When I say we've spent 20 to 30 years sort of putting ourselves in the box, demanding that we live by a variety of international regimes, well, Putin's a very clever guy, and he's using those international regimes against us. And I think our ability to leverage any force against him before he uses force is very limited.
Jake Danishevsky, what is your outlook on the when you were growing up in the former Soviet Union, what did the Russian people, in what kind of regard did they hold their military's capability? Did the Russian people respect their military? Did they admire it, or what did they think?
Well, Russian military is well respected. See, Russia is a military state. It was always, well, not Russia, but Soviet Union, perhaps, was always a military state. The only reason they were able to defeat Hitler is because Russian soldiers, besides being very well trained, just the American military, they're respected, they're angry, and they're always under pressure to do something. I mean, see, Russia has been at war. I mean, Soviet Union and Russia has been at war for many, many years. So the soldiers, the military base, is always, I guess, thrown into situations to defend their country. For example, Nazis attacked Russia. So obviously they had to defend. Russian soldiers were hungry. They were not very well fed. And doctor is right. It's a very under-financed military. But besides that, they were able to fight the Nazis even with lesser weapons because they were angry. And anger builds some kind of adrenaline in you. So I'm not praising Russian military. I'm just stating the fact that it's a very strong military. It's based on constant training. There was a draft until a certain point in Russia. The reason my family left, one of the reasons my family left, because I'm a Soviet Jew, and most likely I would be drafted and shot by my own troops in the military because I was not a very tough guy. So obviously my family did not like that. So besides the fact that military is constantly trained, everybody, most people, 99% of population in the male population goes to military, you have a military constantly at 100% base.
Well, I am remaining very, very concerned about this. Dr. Dave, I'm sure you are as well. And Jake, you know, the last thing in the world that I think anybody wants is for Russia and NATO to be in any kind of an armed conflict. But unfortunately, I think that there are times when that sort of thing is unavoidable. The way to avoid it is to make sure a bully knows that he's not going to get what he wants. And unfortunately, I think it's too late for us right now. I think that ship has already sailed. Would you agree, Dave?
Yes, Duke. I would agree with that, and that's why I think the president and the Secretary of State, and for that matter, Republican leaders in the Congress need to be very careful about overstating their position. The truth is we're not in a strong position right now. And in the military, you never defend the low ground, even if you have to back up to get a better position. And I suspect that that beating our chest right now and making threats and telling how we're going to use sanctions and pushing Putin out of the Crimea, that is probably just not going to happen. And so I think we'd be much better off by explaining what we actually would fight for and our obligation to NATO, our willingness to support Poland, Estonia, Latvia, other members of NATO. I think we'd be much better off to assure them and talk about how they might assist the Ukraine than we would be to try to threaten Putin with something that, frankly, we just can't do.
Well, that's why we positioned those 6 F-15s and aerial refueling tanker. Is that base, I think, is in Lithuania, or is it in Poland that they were moved to?
I think I read Poland, but I just don't know it well enough. But I'll tell you that we've had extensive liaison with all the Baltic states. We've got close relationships with Estonia, and so I would expect that we will be increasing military activities, especially with the nations on the eastern side of NATO, and that makes sense. I don't have any disagreement with that. I just think we'd be very foolish to talk about what we're going to push Putin into doing or what we're going to push him out of. The Crimea is a done deal, and it's time for us to look for high ground, not to continue to slog through trying to defend the low ground.
Jake, any closing thoughts on this situation from you?
Yes, absolutely. I agree with the doctor. I think that ship has sailed. You see, putting F-16s right now on the ground is not going to make a difference because Putin has no respect for our leadership. And once again, I'm not praising Putin. Putin got his position not because he was moved through the ranks or because somebody assisted him or because he organized some community. Putin did not bake a pie to become head of KGB. Putin is a brutal, conniving, lying, smart, and a very, very powerful man. I mean, now, this is the type of a guy that most people might be scared of and might not like, but they do respect him. On the other hand, we have someone like Obama, and I even heard liberal professors say that we don't have somebody in the White House to stand up to Putin. We need someone like Reagan. We need somebody with very bold statements and very bold actions. Obama says, I'm going to be flexible after the election, and he plays this card that he's going to be able to do diplomatic things with Putin. I mean, Putin doesn't care about diplomacy. Putin doesn't care about Obama. He doesn't respect the man. So how can Obama do any action right now by putting planes on the ground? Obama already let that ship sail, like Doctor said.
Gents, thank both of you so much for being with me tonight. This has been a wonderful discussion. I'm keeping my fingers crossed and going to hope we keep our powder dry. Dr. McIntyre, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And Jake, my dear friend, thank you for being with us as well. Have a great evening.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, thank you. Dr. David McIntyre from the Bush School of International Affairs and at Texas A&M University. Dr. McIntyre is a West Point graduate. He has spent his entire career in the United States Army and in the study of international affairs, terrorism and counterterrorism and national security. He is also the author of a really great novel called Centerline. And my good friend Jake Danishevsky, calling from New Jersey, who was born in the old Soviet Union. He and his family just really couldn't stand communism anymore. And as a result, they finally left. Now, we're going to take a real quick break here. I do want to remind you, coming up, I've got Dick Kinsley. Dick is recently retired from Continental Airlines as a senior captain. I'm going to have to call him back because I actually hit the wrong button here on Blog Talk Radio, so I'm going to call Dick. We're going to go to a real quick break. I do want to remind you that those of us here at conservativenationmedia.com take pride in starting off the work week every Monday in a great big way. It's called Inside Tennessee with Dave Vance. Now, even if you're not from the volunteer state, that's what we call Tennessee. It's been called the volunteer state since the War of 1812, but you knew that. The issues that affect Tennessee are spreading out all over America. Dave Vance brings his veterans' insight and the most informative guests to Inside Tennessee every Monday, so make sure to check him out. It's brought to you by the Tennessee Action Council, bunch of good guys there. Inside Tennessee, Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. We're going to talk about the strange disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. It's been gone for about 10 days now. Coming up, a little bit of Civil War history is in the offing as well, so stay right where you are.
The Internet's official rhino hunting safari.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Any daughter would do the same. But soon enough, he needed help doing more things. And it was up to me to be his personal shopper and financial manager, too. And before I knew it, Dad moved in with me. So I became his cook, his personal assistant, his physical therapist, and even his nurse. When I started taking care of Dad, I didn't realize all the roles I'd have to play. But no matter what, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the many roles you play. And to help, we created an online caregiving resource center. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find resources and connect with the caregiving community. Together, we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to learn more. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Been looking for an online gathering place? You know, a familiar screen, does everything you're used to, except give you grief for being a conservative? You gotta try the Tea Party community. At TPC, you'll know how everything works from the very first minute, and you'll probably find a lot of friends who are already there. Organize, communicate, share ideas, upcoming events, pictures, and videos. The Tea Party community connects and empowers like-minded, politically conservative people like you. Sign up today at teapartycommunity.com.
Hi, this is Michael Behrman, inviting you to join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central, on The Michael Behrman Show. Right here on conservativenationmedia.com.
By now, if you are a regular listener to Radio Free America, you know what that means. It is time to talk about a little bit of Civil War history, and then we're going to speak a bit about the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines. And as you are aware, we are now in the 150th anniversary or sesquicentennial of the Civil War, a profoundly important event in world history. And March 19th was a Saturday in 1864, 150 years ago today. This information is from the Civil War Day by Day by E.B. Long and Barbara Long. The Georgia legislature expressed its confidence in President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy and resolved that the Confederate government should, after each victory, make an offer of peace to the North based on independence of the South and self-determination by the border states. Minor fighting continued with action at the Eel River, California, Beersheba Springs, Tennessee, on the Cumberland River in Kentucky, at Laredo, Texas, and Black Bay, Arkansas. Federals scouted for 4 days from Lexington, Missouri, and a Union expedition from Rolling Prairie to Batesville, Arkansas, lasted until April 4th. Back in the 1860s, one would, you know, armies moved differently back then than they do now. The first time that troops were ever brought into combat by train took place in the American Civil War. That was at the First Battle of Manassas, or Bull Run, as it is called in the North. Some people call it the Battle of First Manassas, because there was another battle on the Manassas battlefield in 1864, I believe. Unbelievable carnage as well. A lot of these Civil War battles were just unbelievably brutal. And apparently during the Civil War, more fighting men died of disease and poorly cleaned surgical instruments. Nobody knew anything about microbiology back then. They knew as much about microbiology as we know about the disappearance of Flight 370. Now then, I want to bring in Gent, who has been one of my best friends for about 40 years now. Dick Kinsley has recently retired from Continental and United Airlines as a senior captain on 737s. Dick, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Good to talk to you, Duke.
Good to talk to you, pal. I was just mentioning to all the people that you are a senior, recently retired senior captain, flying the 737, and that was your airplane. You never flew the 74 or the 777 or anything like that, correct? You're a 737 kind of guy, correct?
Well, all my experience was in narrow-body aircraft, the 727, DC-9, MD-80, and then pretty much every variant of the 737. That's correct.
Now, no one has any idea what has happened to that Boeing 777. If you had the choice between flying a Boeing airliner and flying one made by Airbus or Donald Douglas or something, what would be your choice?
Actually, my experience is with McDonnell Douglas and also and Boeing as well. No experience with Airbus. I know the design philosophies of the American manufacturers are a little bit different with regard to automation, but they're all good airplanes. From a statistical standpoint, they're all incredibly reliable, and so I wouldn't hesitate to want to fly on any of them.
Now, we have heard a lot during the last 10 days or so concerning devices called transponders on the Malaysian Airlines jet. Could you tell us just briefly exactly what a transponder does and what it is for and the significance of it being turned off in flight?
Well, the transponder is an aid to the radar tracking of aircraft. Normally, a radar the system is able to pick up aircraft in the air, but there's not a lot of information associated with what we generally refer to as the blip on the radar screen. And what a transponder does is it'll actually bring in encoded data so that an air traffic controller can not only see the blip, which basically just gives range azimuth type information to the controller, and augments that with information as to the specific flight number, airline, altitude, and air.
Dick, are you still there? Are you still there, Dick?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. Yeah, I'm not really sure what happened, but...
Well, I don't know where we left off, but what I was explaining to you, the what the transponder does is it augments the information on the radar screen that an air traffic controller uses to direct air traffic. Normally, with a primary radar return on an air on a radar system, all you're seeing is the blip, and you get some information with regard to the range and distance that the aircraft is from a specific point in space. What the transponder does is augment that basic information with additional information, the aircraft's call sign, the airline, the flight level or altitude that the airline is that the airplane is flying at, and also its airspeed. So it's a lot more positive identification and more useful for the benefit of the air traffic controller trying to track aircraft.
Now, there has been a fair amount of talk about the idea that they have gotten some information either by transponder tracking or by another system on the airplane called ACARS, that the airliner may have gone up to 45,000 feet, which people like you and I would refer to as flight level 450, correct?
Correct.
The airplane, apparently, based on what Boeing has put out, has something known as a maximum certified altitude of 43,100. Not really sure how it could have gotten up the extra 1,900 feet, but in the airplane, the pressurization system doesn't keep the inside of the airplane pressurized to sea level. It keeps it pressurized to a percentage of sea level. Isn't that the, you know, like a 7,000-foot differential, or how does it work on the 7.3?
Yeah, it's the differential relates to pounds per square inch. So they refer to that as PSID, pounds per square inch differential. And most modern aircraft will maintain a sea level pressure up to probably around 18,000 feet or flight level 180. But after that, the airplane's cabin altitude, that's the altitude or the passengers are experiencing in terms of how they would feel if they were at the same elevation, whether it be at sea level or in the mountains and so forth. And typically, an airliner at 35,000 feet might have a 6,000-foot cabin altitude. So that's so you're still breathing thinner air than you would be at sea level, but it's still, you know, fairly comfortable.
Now, if the airplane were to go up to 45,000, that would be really something, but would the cabin pressurization system be able to keep the inside of the cabin at essentially a pressurized level that the people could breathe and remain conscious?
Well, yeah, a nominal increase in altitude would not make a lot of difference with regard to the cabin. In other words, if the airplane is certified for, we'll say, 43,000 feet, and it happens for some reason to climb to 45, the airplane would not be unpressurized. That's not an issue per se. And very often what happens with an aircraft's certified altitude, it has sometimes as much to do with the equipment cooling requirements as it does how well the airplane can fly in that very thin, rarefied air that high up.
And if you're at an altitude like that, I mean, that's up there pretty good, isn't it? The airplane itself has a very narrow range of airspeed. If you fall below a certain airspeed, you may stall. And if you go above that airspeed, you may face structural problems with the airplane. Is that about right?
That's correct. At sea level, an airplane might be very comfortable flying as slow as, we'll say, 120 miles an hour, and as fast as 350 miles an hour before it was getting into high-speed buffeting at the higher end and approaching an aerodynamic stall at the lower end. So that's a huge margin at sea level, but as you climb in altitude, the window of acceptability, aerodynamic acceptability, narrows tremendously. And so as you're at the highest altitudes, maintaining proper airspeed is of paramount importance.
Dick, I've got to take a brief break. Can I ask you to hang in here with me through this break, and can we pick up our conversation again in about 2.5 minutes?
We sure can, as long as the questions don't get any more difficult.
You just hang in there, buddy, and I'll, you know, I'm going to bring up the SJ in a couple of minutes as well, so just stay right where you are. Okay. All right, now then, we will be back with Captain Dick Kinsley. Dick, the first time he ever flew an aircraft was in the spring of 1977, but, you know, perhaps we'll talk about that in a moment or two. You know, you've heard me mention before, one of the worst things that can possibly happen to anybody today is to be a victim of identity theft. I hope it never happens to you, but if it does, it could take months or even longer to recover from it, if you actually recover at all. So here's my suggestion. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance. Sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is much more than just a standard credit monitoring service. They help to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service 24/7, 365. There really is nothing that comes close to LifeLock. So to protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. That network may not cover all transactions, and the scope may vary. Nothing can protect you from all identity theft, but LifeLock does as good a job in it as anybody can. Go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. You will be very glad that you did. You will be very glad that you stand by through these brief commercial announcements. Captain Dick Kinsley and I will be back, so don't go away.
Hey everybody, Rachel Ray here. Nothing puts a bigger smile on my face than cooking up a big meal for family and friends. But there's not enough room at my table for the 17 million kids in America who are struggling with hunger. These children, that's one out of every five, often have to skip meals because there's just nothing to eat in the kitchen. Yet there's more than enough healthy, nutritious food produced right here in America to feed every last hungry child. If only there was a way to get it to them. That's why the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food to give hope to hungry kids and their families all across our country. But they can't do it without your help. Join me in supporting Feeding America at your local food bank and at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Molon LeVay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase Molon LeVay, which translated means come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
In Cowboy Town.
Hey y'all, I'm Kixbrook.
I'm Ronnie Dunn.
And we're Brooke.
And Dunn for Rad. And I've got a four-letter word for you. Don't. As in don't drive drunk.
And I got a three-letter word for you as in get. Get the keys.
When you see someone who's about to drive under the influence,
get the keys.
Because friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Rad, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change? You're listening to Duke Brooks on ConservativeNationRadio.org.
All righty, welcome back. We've got about 20 minutes left in this episode of Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Duke Brooks here, and I am joined now from Texas by Captain Dick Kinsley, recently retired, one of the leading 737 pilots in the world. Dick, do you have any thoughts as to what may possibly have happened with Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, why it made the turns it did, why they turned off the transponder? Apparently somebody had to go below decks into the electronics bay to pull the circuit breaker on the ACARS system. What do these things tell you, if anything?
Very, very little. And as you know, I'm very hesitant to ever speculate. I would want to remind your listeners that when there's an accident investigation in the United States, you know, the NTSB has a GO team that arrives within hours, and there's plenty of information sharing that's very accurate, very immediate, and none of that has happened in this particular accident or hijacking or whatever it may turn out to be. And it bothers me a little bit that there's been, you know, kind of an entertainment value to all the speculation, and unfortunately 239 people may be in jeopardy. And so obviously my heart, our hearts and prayers should go out to that crew. I can also tell you that in my airline career, or as a professional pilot for about 35 years, I've flown on five different aircraft that have later crashed when being flown by another crew. And I was intimately involved in all of those aircraft, and as given the amount of expert knowledge I had, I was still amazed at the early stages as to how difficult it is to properly speculate or ultimately end up being right in your speculation. So I'm really hesitant to ever speculate. Wouldn't want to do it in this forum, and it's the kind of thing that professionals should really share in a working way with fellow professionals, and that's about the most constructive thing I can suggest. I really don't have anything to add on this. There's just very few clues on this one, but even were there more clues, I'd be probably as hesitant to speculate. Sorry about that.
Well, that's all right. And, you know, in the United States, we obviously have the finest airspace system in the world. We have the best aircraft in the world. Obviously, we have the best pilots and the best air traffic control system in the world and the best aviation accident investigation capability in the world. Malaysia, obviously, is a third world country. It should be very clear. Those poor guys are in over their head over there trying to figure out what happened to this airplane. Now, the ACARS system, this automatic aviation reporting system, what are all the parameters that it sends, and how exactly does it send them?
Well, interestingly enough, the system has expanded so fast over the last, you know, 25 years, it's just amazing it used to be mostly for flight following purposes under Part 121 of the FARs. Obviously, the airline has to know where the airplane is, and so the ACARS, its principal function was to let the company know when the airplane blocked out for taxi, when it took off, when it landed, and when it taxied in at the destination. So that was the primary function. Later they added things like some engine reporting parameters, and initially the parameters were entered manually on the keyboard that on the surface of the ACARS unit. But now the ACARS serve so many functions, and most of them are automated. And they really, the pilots have nothing to do with the cars, you know, operationally. There's not much the pilot has to do with ACARS. Of course, flight plans can now come across the ACARS printer. So the role of the ACARS just keeps expanding. And there's things that I'm not even aware of that are probably on the 777 and now that provide even more data.
You're not even aware? Dick, who was the first human being that ever allowed you to operate an airplane in flight?
Probably the same guy that let me fly a helicopter the first time. I think it was you.
Teach you anything? I mean, you should know these things, Dick. No, I'm only kidding with you, buddy. But listen, it's about time for us to go. I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. You know, you are absolutely correct. A lot of these discussions have gone into wild and baseless speculation, and I think you're absolutely correct. A lot of it is being driven by certain newscasters and talk show hosts' desire to keep this story alive. I think that there are more important things, but I'm also very, very worried about the idea that this airplane may have simply been stolen and the guys flying it may have had something to do with it. It's a, to me, it has Mohammedan terrorism written all over it, but, you know, we have no idea. Only time will tell. Thank you for calling in, my buddy. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, dude. Thanks very much.
Give my best to Karen, Harrison, and Kristen, okay?
I sure will. Okay.
All right. Thanks, pal. See you soon. All righty. It is time for us to take a little break. Always great to speak with Dick Kinsley. He and I made a lot of parachute jumps together. We did a lot of flying together, and Dick is a profoundly competent, focused, and amazingly well-disciplined pilot. He had a wonderful career with Continental. They merged with United, and Dick is a particularly smart guy, very, very smart guy, and he just figured it was time for him to retire, I guess. So he can now take it easy. Anyway, we've got about 13 and a half minutes to go. We are going to take a real quick break. A couple of closing thoughts, and I hope that Christian will be calling in right after this, so don't go away.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here?
As a young teenage boy, I didn't even know what autism was. How do you even spell that? A few years later, I heard that a friend's cousin's son had been diagnosed with autism.
I still wasn't sure what that really meant.
When I went to college, my roommate's brother had autism. When I moved to the city for work, my best friend called me and told me his son had been diagnosed with autism. We were both in shock. I still remember the day I walked into the house and saw that look on my wife's face. I knew something was wrong. I'll never forget how I felt when she said, "Our son has autism."
Autism is getting closer to home. Today, 1 in 88 children is diagnosed with autism. That's a 1,000% increase in the last 40 years. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
Want to help those affected by Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines? To donate, visit philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. That's philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Dave Vance inviting you to join me every Monday night for Inside Tennessee on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Even if you're not from the volunteer state, you'll want to know what's happening because one day it will affect you. Every week you'll hear interviews with experts, legislators, and citizens who are fed up and making a stand. So join us every Monday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central Time for Inside Tennessee on conservativenationmedia.com.
Listening to Duke Brooks on conservativenationradio.org.
All righty, welcome back to this 2 days after St. Patty's Day edition of Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Duke Brooks here. That, of course, the great Lorena McKinnitt and Mummers Dance from about 1997, I think. There was a time in the mid to late 90s when virtually all female artists that were heard on the radio in this country were either Irish, or they were lesbians, or they were Irish lesbians, or they were lesbian Irish. You know, I don't – who knows what these trends are all about? You know, I guess at the end of the day, and I say this because I'm a conservative Republican, what consenting adults do behind closed doors is nobody's business than their own. But I can tell you, I think K.D. Lang is an unbelievably talented artist. I mean, she's brilliant. Christian, welcome back, my friend. How are you doing? What do you think happened to that airliner? And please don't tell me it's under your couch in Denmark.
No, I'm sure it ain't. Just a vacuum, and I didn't see an airplane down there. So no, I'm sure it ain't down there, but I was just making a joke before. I totally agree with you. It has Muslim terrorism written all over it because, you know, they're the only ones that crazy enough to do such a thing. I had a friend that knows a lot about these things. He told me that this sort of thing has only like happened 3 times in a long while. And all the times the pilots have been Muslims. And the two pilots that flew this plane was Muslims. So I just think that it's perhaps it's time to let the travelers know what faith the pilot has, because, you know, if the risk of the plane disappearing increases dramatically if the pilot is Muslim, shouldn't the travelers shouldn't they have the right to know that information?
So I agree with
can
you.
Say, yeah, so perhaps then they can say, okay, then perhaps we want to fly with someone else.
Maybe they should only be allowed to fly on Muslim airlines, and you know, I mean, it's true that not all Muslims are terrorists, but it is also true that all terrorists are Muslim. Christian, let me put you on hold for just a moment here. I want to bring in our good friend Matthew Opalisky. Matthew, welcome aboard, my friend. What's happening, pal? How are you?
Hey, good evening, Mr. Duke. I hear you must have a spirited discussion going on having to do with, airplanes and terrorism. A funny thing is going on in Malaysia, isn't it?
Well, it is sort of a mystery right now, but when you factor in the Mohammedans, you factor in the fact that Malaysia is a third world country, their radar is not as good over there. I mean, you're talking about Malaysia and Vietnam, and the range of that airplane and all that kind of stuff, you know, frankly, I hope I'm wrong, but I suspect that this is a Muslim terror operation.
I would probably tend to agree with you, although what was the press headline coming out of it, you know, in day one and two? This is not a terrorism event. No terrorism around here. No, sorry, Bob. It's unfortunate for the families involved, but I don't think this. I mean, you know, I don't have anywhere near the aviation experience you do, but I don't see it ending well. And again, unfortunate as it is, I just, you know, you can hold out hope, but I think that, you know, at some point you need to face reality too.
Well, I agree. Now, what's in store tomorrow night on the Liberty and Constitution community at 8 o'clock here on conservativenationmedia.com? What do you got going on,
buddy? We've got a lot of stuff going on. None of it's good, I'm sure. Good insofar as liberty is concerned. We're going to talk about a lot of liberty being trampled. Some of it local, some of it not so much local. I don't know if you're aware or your listeners are aware of the blatant stripping of the Fourth Amendment search and seizure practices that happened over in Western Maryland when they shut down a complete highway with 30 to 40 vehicles, helicopters, and went car to car, not door to door like they did in Watertown, Mass. They went car to car with their rifles looking for robbery suspects and shut down. Like I said, they shut down, I believe it was Highway 270 in Western Maryland, for upwards of 3 to 4 hours, just walk, and they walked. The police walked car to car, telling people, pop the trunk, pop the trunk, pop the trunk, you know, at gunpoint. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Here in Delaware, we actually had what some folks who, I don't know, call them in the know, call them hopefuls, or call it a good thing. There was a ruling that came out of the Supreme Court of the state of Delaware that what some folks are saying, oh, it's a Second Amendment victory. Well, I don't know. Basically, the Supreme Court of the state of Delaware is saying that the Second Amendment means what I already knew it meant. It's kind of like them saying, well, yes, all yellow cars are, in fact, yellow. They're upholding that the Second Amendment means you have a right to keep and bear arms. Okay, well, that's great. It has to do with the Wilmington Housing Authority, and I'll get into that a little bit as to, well, why I don't look at it as a victory, because the Second Amendment was settled in 1791, so, of course, a court can't give me the right to keep and bear arms. I was born with it as an American. What else can we talk about? Hey, Ocean City, they had a big giant checkpoint on St. Paddy's Day. They had Route 50 shut down for a couple hours as they did their illegal checkpoint looking for drunkards because there's always some reason to throw away why the Constitution is a good thing, and there's always a good reason to trample it, don't you know?
Oh, absolutely, and, you know, in some countries, they will use the excuse that the security of the state is more important than the rights of the individuals. And in this country, they always use the excuse that public safety demands that you cede some of your rights to us. You know, no matter what, there's always going to be somebody that's going to want to take your rights away from you. And I'm very, very glad that we've got you on our side, because you're keeping the magnifying glass on these guys. Matthew, I can't wait for tomorrow night. And, you know, after your show tomorrow night, we have a new program that will be making its debut here on conservativenationmedia.com. It's called Graceland with our good friend Jennifer Meadows. She will be doing a one-hour program on Thursday nights, starting tomorrow night. So not only will you be on the air for 2 hours, but I'm sure you're going to be listening to 1 hour of Graceland tomorrow night. I know I will, buddy.
Yep.
Thank you for calling in, my friend. Thank you, my friend, and I look forward to hearing you tomorrow night. Okay. All right. Now, Christian, welcome back from Denmark, my friend. We've got about 2 minutes left, and when Matthew and I were talking about the Second Amendment, and I know, Christian, that you are familiar with it, I was thinking, what does a guy like Christian, who was born in a European country, think about the idea that in America we have the right to keep and bear arms built into our Constitution? Most Europeans must find that to be shocking.
That is true, but I think that since our country became multiracial, I think we need to have a Second Amendment too. And I'm whenever I'm debating politics in Denmark, I bring up that point, and I'm fighting for creating the possibilities of Danish people being able to bear arms and defend themselves. I think it should be a given right, and you guys should be very grateful that you have the ability to fight for yourself and defend yourself and the one
well,
that you love.
I have believed
so
for a very long time.
So let me say this. Remember to support your local NRA department.
Absolutely, yes. I believe for a very long time, Christian, that an armed society is a polite society. Now then,
so
we only have a couple of seconds left, and I know you're going to be in Denmark in early May, but you'll notice that on Facebook today, I mentioned to you that we're going to have a big cookout here, and if I can figure out a way to get you over to the United States, I absolutely will. But thank you for calling in, my friend. I will keep you posted.
You're welcome. God bless you.
And I look forward to – and thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. All righty. That will just about do it for this edition of Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. Thanks very much for being along. Duke Brooks here. I look forward to speaking to you next Wednesday and every Wednesday till God forbid. Have a great night. Have a great week. And thanks again. See you soon.